They called it a cure-all, and that was the warning. As W.E.B. Du Bois put it, ignorance is a cure for nothing, because anything that promises to fix everything usually fixes nothing, except maybe the seller's bottom line.
History is messy,
weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're rainy day rabbit holes,
exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Before we get started, we've got a special treat for you today. Instead of our usual rabbit hole, we're opening the door to something a little darker. This episode comes from one of the shows in our Umbrella Podcast Collective, a gathering of podcasts that explore history and culture, all while creating a positive and supportive community. You can learn more about the collective at rainydayrabbitholes.com/umbrella-collective. The podcast you're about to hear from is Dark History, Where the Darkness Sees the Light, hosted by Rob Bradley. And that title isn't just branding. Rob has a knack for dragging forgotten stories out of the shadows and holding them up long enough for you to realize they were never really gone. This episode dives into the history of snake oil, the grift, the spectacle, the lies dressed up as cures. What starts as a look at 19th century medicine shows quickly becomes something more uncomfortable, a reminder that deception doesn't die. It adapts. It modernizes. It rebrands. This is one of my favorite episodes that Rob has done, because by the end, it's hard not to recognize the patterns. The language changes, the platforms change, but the harm doesn't. So take a breath, lower the lights if you can, and listen closely. Here's Dark History. You can find a link to Dark History in the show notes.
There is a sound that has echoed, unchanged through the centuries. It's not the crash of thunder or the roar of a crowd. It's the sound of a child's cough in the dead of night. A dry, desperate hack that seems to scrape against the very walls of a quiet house. In a gaslit London bedroom in the 1860s, or a drafty Priory homestead in the 1880s, that sound was the signal for pure terror. It was a siren call to the spectres of diphtheria, whooping cough, and consumption, diseases that carried off the young with chilling, random efficiency. Medicine, in those hours, felt less like a science and more like a collection of folk remedies and brutal guesswork. Doctors, if they could be afforded and reached, were distant figures of dubious skill, often armed with little more than leeches, lancets, and a grim faith in the heroic purge. For mothers like Clara, cradling her feverish 2-year-old son Arthur in the long, dark hours before dawn, each ragged breath he took was a turn of the screw. The rhythm of his suffering became the rhythm of the night. She had moved through the familiar, helpless litiger of home care. The warm compresses on the little chest that cooled too quickly. The spoonfuls of honey that stuck in its constricted throat. The desperate prayers whispered into his damp hair. Pleas that seemed to vanish into the oppressive silence of the room. The local physician, when finally summoned after days of worsening crisis, had performed the standard sanctioned act of bloodletting, hoping to balance the boy's humours. It left Arthur paler, weaker, a faint blue tracing his eyelids, but no quieter. The cough continued, a metronome of misery. Clara's helplessness was no longer an emotion, it was a physical weight. A stone on her chest, as tangible as the child in her arms. Then, the promise arrived. It drifted into her world not as a miracle, but as mundane print, nestled among shipping news and political debates in the Times. It was a bold advertisement, featuring a cherubic, slumbering infant, his skin porcelain perfect, its expression one of angelic peace. Mrs. Wilmslow's soothing syrup, the elegant script declared, for children teething, it soothes the child, softens the gums, ails all pain, relieves wind, regulates the bowels, and gives rest to the mother. That final line was a masterstroke, a piece of copywriting genius that pierced through the fog of exhaustion. It gives rest to the mother. For Clara, whose nerves were frayed to fragments, and whose eyes burned with the lack of sleep, it was not a sales pitch. It was a lifeline, thrown into a stormy sea. It spoke directly to her guilt, her fear, her crumbling resolve. It offered not just a cure for the child, but salvation for herself. The syrup itself, procured with urgent hope from the chemist, was an unassuming liquid, thick, sweet, and the colour of weak tea. It smelt faintly of spices and sugar, a comforting aroma. With trembling hands, Clara administered a teaspoon, prizing open Arthur's tiny, hot mouth. The wait that followed was agonizing, but within 20 minutes, a modern miracle occurred in that ancient room. Arthur's frantic cries guttered and died. The constant, pitiful thrashing of his limbs stilled. The tension that had knotted his small body seemed to melt away. His eyelids, heavy as stones, slid shut. He sank into a profound, unnervingly deep slumber, his breath becoming slower and regular for the first time in days. The silence that replaced that cacophony of illness was immense, almost sacred. Clara wept with relief, her tears washing away the grime of fear. She believed, with every fibre of her being, that she had found a godsend, a benevolent, scientific marvel in a bottle. What she had actually done, with all the love in her heart, was dose her son with a lethal and addictive cocktail of morphine sulfate and grain alcohol. This was not medicine. It was a chemical restraint, a form of quietistic torture that traded conscious suffering for unconscious peril. The syrup did not cure teething, colic or coughs. It simply rendered the nervous system incapable of registering the pain, while quietly depressing the respiratory system to the brink of failure. It was a product born not in laboratories, but in ledger books, sold in a bottle adorned with the benevolent, matronly face of a fictional Mrs. Wilmslow, a label designed to inspire maternal trust while delivering narcotic oblivion. And this bottle was not a solitary monster. It was just one item of a vast, crowded shelf in the grand, macabre, and breathtakingly profitable emporium of 19th century quackery. It shared space with liniments that promised to grow hair but burnt scalp, with belts that claimed to harness electromagnetic vitality to cure paralysis, with pills for female complaints, laced with arsenic, to produce a fashionable pallor. Clara's story was not an anomaly. It was a template. It was an opening chapter in a relentless story of commercialized hope, where the most valuable human fears, of pain, of decay, of loss, were systematically identified, packaged, and sold back to the desperate, at a markup that was measured not just in coin, but in lives quietly, acceptably extinguished. This was the grim foundation upon which an entire shimmering edifice of patented medicine was built, not on healing, but of the masterful, murderous exploitation of silence. Hi everybody and welcome back to the Dark History Podcast, where we delve into the darkest parts of human history. I hope you're all well. I'm Rob, your host as always, and you've tuned in to Season 5, Episode 4. We often think of the past as a more innocent time, but when it came to the business of health, the past was lawless, terrifying, and a spectacularly innovative frontier. For centuries, before regulation, before clinical trials, before the very idea of informed consent, the pursuit of a cure was a carnival of the bizarre and the deadly. It was a world where the line between healer and huckster vanished in the puff of a showman's smoke, where the dazzling language of new science was used to sell poison, where public depression was the most valuable currency. Today, we're taking a deeper dive into that world. We'll walk the aisles of Victorian pharmacies of nightmares. We'll meet the charismatic peddlers and unpack their deadly wares. But this isn't just a tour of archaic horrors, because the ghost of the 19th century snake oil salesman never died. He just got a digital upgrade. He traded his horse-drawn wagon for a viral TikTok account, his newspaper ad for a targeted Instagram campaign. The potions have new names, biohacking protocols, miracle mineral solution, quantum healing pendants. But the playbook is hauntingly identical. Locate a deep primal fear, promise a simple, miraculous solution, and sell it. So, let's grab that credit card and travel back to a time of radiation and morphine-addicted children, and more dark history. The 19th century was a perfect storm for medical deception. Rapid industrialization crammed people into filthy, disease-ridden cities. Modern medicine was stumbling towards the Enlightenment. Germ theory was still radical. Anesthesia was new and frightening. And the visit from a licensed doctor could easily end up in bleeding, blistering, or toxic mercury purge. The public lived in a state of low-grade panic about their health. And into this void of understanding and trust marched the quack. He was not a sinister figure in a shadowy alley. He was often a charming, confident showman, armed with the era's greatest marvels. The most insidious products targeted the most vulnerable. Mrs. Wilmslow's soothing syrup was not an anomaly. It had cousins like Godfrey's cordial and the street's infant quietness. These soothing syrups, for teething and colic, were, in truth, powerful narcotic cocktails. They were essentially opium or morphine solutions, sweetened to mask the bitter taste. They worked with dreadful efficiency. The baby stopped crying. They slept. Exhausted parents, seeing the immediate peace, hailed them as miracles. They had no idea they were addicting their infant or, in countless tragic cases, administering a fatal overdose. The deaths were often quietly recorded as convulsions or crib death, the tiny victims of a silent, profitable epidemic. If the syrups exploited parental love, other quackeries exploited the awe of scientific discovery. When Wilhelm Röntgen discovered X-rays in 1895 and Marie Curie isolated radium, the public were fascinated by these invisible, seemingly magical forces. Quacks were quick to harness the hype. If X-rays could see through flesh, surely radioactivity could revitalize it. Thus was born the era of radioactive cure-alls. The most infamous was Radithor, a simple bottle of distilled water laced with radium-226, and radium-228. Marketed as a cure for over 150 ailments, from arthritis and gout to impotency and high blood pressure. It was a status symbol for the wealthy and gullible. Industrialist and socialite Eben Byers was the most famous devotee, drinking over 1,400 bottles on his doctor's advice. The results were not rejuvenation, but a slow, gruesome disillusion. His teeth fell out. His jawbone literally crumbled. His skeleton became so riddled with radiation-induced cancer that it glowed in the dark. He died an agonizing death in 1932, and his corpse was so radioactive it required a lead-lined coffin. Radithor was a chilling lesson in the allure of cutting-edge science, and that science is wielded by profit-driven hands. Alongside radiation, another invisible force captured the public's imagination: electricity. The world was being wired, and the crackling of power promised a futuristic utopia. Dozens of devices pledged to channel this power into the human body. The violet ray was the star. This handheld device, with its mesmerizing glowing glass electrodes, was waved over the body to treat everything from tuberculosis and diabetes to acne and baldness. It delivered a mild, tingling shock and a fascinating violet light show. It did absolutely nothing medically, but the experience felt potent, scientific and modern. People felt something happening, and in the world of quackery, sensation was often mistaken for cure. It was the perfect placebo, powered by the theater of technology. Perhaps the most systemic horror, however, was not sold by traveling hucksters, but practiced by esteemed, licensed physicians. This was the doctrine of heroic medicine, championed by figures like Dr. Benjamin Rush. The theory held that disease was caused by an imbalance in the bodies for humans, and the cure was to violently purge the system back into balance. This led to two widespread and devastating practices. The first was the most famous, bloodletting, where patients were drained of a pint of blood, often until they fainted, in a misguided attempt to reduce excitement or fever. The second was the administration of calomel, a mercurous chloride powder. Calomel was a brutally efficient purgative. It caused violent vomiting, diarrhea, and excessive salivation. It also attacked the soft tissue of the mouth, causing gums to ulcerate, teeth to loosen, and jawbones to necrotize and sometimes fall out, a condition called mercurial erethism. Patients were quite literally being poisoned and tortured in the name of healing. The dramatic physical effects, the purging, the salivation, was taken as proof of the disease leaving the body, even as the cure was killing the patient. The common thread weaving through these disparate horrors, the syrup, the radium, the electric wands, the mercury, was a masterful manipulation of human psychology. The quacks, whether a patent medicine salesman or a respected doctor, followed a timeless script. Find a terrifying or incurable problem. Offer a simple, tangible solution that feels powerful. Dress it in the trappings of the latest science and provide immediate, dramatic proof of it working, even if the proof was a symptom of poisoning. So, let's pause to codify this script that I was talking about in the previous section. This playbook is written in the ink of human fear and sold for gold. It's not a complex manifesto, but a brutally effective four-act drama that has played to packed houses for centuries. Understanding these acts is not an academic exercise. It's the key to recognising the performance when the curtain rises again. Whether on a gaslit stage or in the glowing rectangle of your smartphone. Act 1 identifies the perfect fear. This is the cornerstone, the soil in which the entire scheme takes root. The quack is a master cartographer of human anxiety. He does not create fear. He simply finds it, names it, and magnifies it. The most lucrative fears share common traits. They are either chronic, a lingering, grinding condition like arthritis or nerves, deeply embarrassing, like syphilis, baldness, or, in inverted commas, female troubles. Or they exist in the terrifying realm of the incurable, where mainstream medicine shrugs its shoulders with a somber, unsatisfactory prognosis. In the 19th century, this meant consumption, a wasting death sentence, or hysteria, a catch-all for any female emotion that inconvenienced the patriarchy. De Quack's genius was offering a solution that was not just a treatment, but a transaction of dignity. Private, shame-free, and promising control where there was only chaos. Today, the fear has been rebranded for a secular, sanitized age. They are the invisible toxins supposedly lurking in our food and water. The vague but menacing inflammation. The spiritually bankrupting low vibrational energy. Or the pervasive anxiety of failing at wellness in a culture that has commodified optimal living. The fear is no longer just a disease, but of not being your most radiant, productive and purified self. With Act 2, they weaponize hope with scientific hooks. Once fear has its grip, hope must be deployed. But not a gentle, patient hope. A revolutionary, simple and technologically dazzling hope. The solution cannot sound old or familiar. It must smell of the future. It must be dressed in the most thrilling language of the age. The 19th century quack was a magpie for scientific breakthroughs. When the public fascination landed on invisible forces, he was ready with the magnetic belt to cure paralysis, the galvanic device to restore vitality, the radioactive tonic to grant the eternal youth. The science was irrelevant. The awe was the product. Today, the vocabulary has evolved, but the trick is identical. The hook is quantum, a word lifted from physics and stripped of all meaning to suggest limitless, mythical potential. It's biohacking, framing the body as a machine to be jailbroken with simple supplements. It's frequency healing or mitochondrial optimization, phrases that sound profoundly technical to the layperson, creating an aura of elite, forbidden knowledge. The jargon is not meant to educate, it's meant to overwhelm, to enchant, to make the customer feel like they're accessing secret science that the dull, plodding medical establishment is too rigid to understand. Following Act 2 is Act 3, providing potent, immediate proof. Abstract hope is not enough. The body itself must bear witness. The customer must feel the product working, in a way that is dramatic and tangible. This is where the quack's chemistry becomes darkly theatrical. The proof is really the quiet, gradual work of real healing. It's a violent, unmistakable reaction. Mrs. Winslow's syrup provided irrefutable proof. The screaming infant fell into a death-like silence. What the mother witnessed was not healing, but narcotic suppression. The calomel purge provided proof The patient was violently, spectacularly emptied. What the doctor saw as a balancing of the humours was actually acute mercury poisoning. The modern detox tea provides proof. The rapid weight loss and dramatic cleansing effect. What the user experiences is not a release of toxins, but a traumatic response of the gut ravaged by industrial strength laxatives. The brilliance and the horror of this act is that it co-opts the body's own distress signals. Pain, purging, and systematic shock are rebranded as healing crises, detox reactions, or the release of deep-seated impurities. The very harm becomes the sale pitch. Of course, after Act 3 is Act 4. Attack the establishment and cultivate community. Finally, the quack must fortify his customers against the outside world. Doubt is the enemy, so an enemy must be created. He positions himself as the brave maverick, the lone truth teller battling the monolithic, corrupt establishment. The 19th century professor, on his wagon, rallied against the expensive, elitist regular doctor with his painful outdated methods. Today's gurus attack Big Pharma, a faceless corporate entity accused of suppressing cures for profit, and allopathic medicine painted as soulless systems that treat symptoms but never the root cause. This narrative is profoundly powerful. It transforms scepticism from a healthy impulse into a moral failing, a sign that one is still asleep or in the system. It forges a powerful us-versus-them bond amongst followers. Online, this evolves into digital tribes, private Facebook groups, subscriber-only forums, and comment sections that become echo chambers for affirmation. Within these walls, testimonials are scripture, critics are trolls or agents of the establishment, and the guru's authority is absolute. The community doesn't just believe in the product, it believes in the war, and that belief insulates them against all contradictive evidence. This timeless playbook was honed on wooden stages under tent awnings. Its rhythms practiced in the call and response of the medicine shows. Its resilience is not just impressive, it is terrifying in its adaptability. It proves that while our technology rockets forward, our underlying psychology, our vulnerability to fear, our hunger for simple miracles, our tribal instincts, remain a constant. And as we now step into a digital age, we are about to witness this ancient script performing on the most global, intimate, and hyper-connective stage ever built, where the stakes are not a few coins tossed into a hat, but the collective health and reason of millions. The travelling medicine show never really disappeared. It just adapted. The tents came down, but the pitch moved online. To people scrolling alone at 2 a.m, anxious, tired and looking for answers. The salesman didn't vanish either. He upgraded. He now speaks in calm, reassuring tones, framed by podcast lighting and a carefully polished personal brand designed to look honest, reliable and safe. There's always a product link, always a course, always a supplement stack waiting at the end. And the audience isn't random either. It's actively hunted. Algorithms identify fear faster than any carnival barker ever could. Search for fatigue, anxiety, chronic pain, weight loss, autism, cancer, aging. And within hours, the miracle cures start to appear. The targeted, persistent, and difficult to avoid. But strip away the branding, and it's the same old business model. Find the worried, promise control, monetize the desperation. You see, the soothing syrups never died. It simply rebranded as a detox culture. Victorian parents feared sick children. Today, we're encouraged to fear invisible contamination everywhere. Toxins in our food, chemicals in water, pollution in the air, radiation from devices, stress supposedly poisoning the soul. Some concerns are legitimate, most are exaggerated, but all are profitable. And this is where detox products slide neatly into that anxiety. Teas, powders, juice cleanses, supplements with clinical-looking labels and carefully vagued promises. A reset, a cleanse, purification. Words that sound medical but rarely mean anything measurable. Look closer, and many rely on simple laxatives like Senna or Cascara Sagrada, irritating the intestines until the body flushes itself out. That dramatic reaction gets reaffirmed as toxins leave in the system. In reality, it's often fluid loss, electrolyte imbalance, and a stressed gut microbiome, sometimes followed by lingering digestive problems. Then the trap tightens. After a cleanse, your body feels off, tired, bloated, unsettled. That discomfort gets framed as fresh toxins building up, so you buy another cleanse. This isn't wellness, it's a feedback loop built on discomfort. Create the problem, sell the relief, repeat. Mrs. Wilmslow's soothing syrup sedated children into silence. Detox culture often does something similar to adults, dulling symptoms, ignoring causes, and calling the numbness balance. The old radioactive miracle cure has evolved too. Reborn as energy mysticism, people have always loved invisible forces. Radiation once sounded magical. Now it's quantum vibration, biofields, frequencies, and energy alignment. Real scientific terms hollowed out until they are effectively meaningless. You can buy adhesive patches that supposedly neutralize electromagnetic radiation, pendants that optimize cellular vibration, bracelets meant to stabilize your energy field, even expensive machines that pulse light and sound while promising to recharge your body like a battery. They hum softly, glow gently, vibrate just enough to feel convincing. But the science isn't misunderstood. It's completely absent. What these products really sell is reassurance against modern-day fears that our technological world is inherently toxic and corrupting. The cure often isn't evidence-based medicine, but more mystified technology, repackaged as salvation. It becomes a neat, closed loop. Technology scares you. A different technology saves you. Payments required up front. Then there's MMS, where the mask slips completely. Miracle mineral solution sounds benign. It isn't. It's sodium chloride converted into chlorine dioxide. Essentially, industrial bleach used in water treatment and textile processing. Yet online communities have promoted it as a cure for autism, cancer, malaria, HIV, COVID-19, almost anything you can name. Some advocates tell people to drink it. Others instruct parents to administer it rectally to autistic children. The consequences aren't subtle. Chemical burns, vomiting, bloody diarrhea, severe dehydration, hospitalization, and documented deaths. It isn't misguided wellness. It's bodily harm rebranded as treatment. The marketing language stays careful though. Detox reaction, parasite cleansing, oxygen therapy. Suffering gets reaffirmed as healing. Evidence becomes proof of suppression. Regulators become villains. Online echo chambers reinforce the belief. Question it, and you're labelled a shill, a sheep, brainwashed. People double down rather than admit they may have harmed themselves or their children. That psychological lock-in is powerful and dangerous. Because the real product often isn't supplements, it's distrust. Modern wellness grafters rarely stop at one product. They sell a worldview built on suspicion. Doctors are corrupt. Scientists are bought. Regulators are compromised. The media is lying, and pharmaceutical companies are the villains. Some criticism of these institutes is fair. Blind trust isn't healthy, but total distrust is extremely profitable. It removes competition. If mainstream medicine is evil, anything alternative looks heroic. Once someone buys into that worldview, evidence stops mattering. Warnings become confirmation. Fact-checking becomes conspiracy. Doubt becomes weakness. Community forms around that shared belief. And leaving it can mean social, identity, and even financial loss. So people stay. Sometimes even when harm becomes obvious. The scale today is unprecedented. A Victorian quack might reach a handful of towns. A modern one reaches millions overnight. Bad advice spreads faster than corrections. Regulations struggle to keep pace, and platforms reward engagement rather than accuracy. The aesthetic is clean. Calm colours, soft music, words like holistic, natural, balanced, empowered. But underneath often sits the same crude engine. Fear, hope, money, and sometimes real physical damage. Because this isn't harmless. People delay proper treatment. Chronic conditions worsen. Money drains away. Relationships fracture. Children get pulled into risky protocols. Some people become seriously ill, and a few don't recover. And the darkest part is that it really feels like exploitation from the inside. It feels like taking control, like liberation. The medicine show is permanent now. There isn't a closing time. There's no tent to pack away, no travelling required. Just endless content, endless production, endless reassurance that the real danger is everyone else but the person selling the cure. The language sounds modern. The branding looks sophisticated. The science is often cosmetic at best, fictional at worst. But the core exchange hasn't changed in centuries. Fear traded for hope, hope traded for money, and sometimes money traded for harm. Meanwhile, the crowd keeps on scrolling. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this differently dark episode. So where does that leave us? Navigating a world where historical and the digital quackery blur. The lesson is not that all alternative ideas are bad, or that mainstream medicine is flawless. The lesson is about the immune system we must cultivate. A robust personal scepticism. The true miracle cure is not a potion, but a process of questioning. When you encounter a health claim, listen to the echoes of the old playbook. Is it targeting a deep, poorly understood fear? Is it using scientific-sounding jargon to explain a miraculously simple solution? Does it provide proof that is real, not just a dramatic physical reaction? Does it ask you to distrust all external authorities in favour of its own gospel? Let's be brutally honest for a moment. If these miracle teas, these quantum pendants, these bleach protocols actually worked, if they could generally cure cancer, reverse autism, or purge the body of unnamed toxins, do you really believe they'd be that secret? Do you think their inventor would be selling them through Instagram stories from the back of a digital wagon, relying on affiliate links and five-star reviews in unmoderated Facebook groups? Let's follow the logic. The global pharmaceutical industry, Big Pharma as it's called, is a trillion-dollar machine motivated, above all else, by profit. It employs the brightest minds and spends billions on research. If there was a genuine, providable, reproducible cure for major diseases hiding in a bottle of mineral solution or a bag of herbal tea, what do you suppose would happen? They wouldn't suppress it. They wouldn't hide it. They would own it. They would patent the formula. They would run clinical trials. They would get it approved by every regulatory board on the planet. And then they would sell it. Not for £40 on a Shopify site, but for tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of pounds per treatment. They would become the undisputed heroes of modern science, and the shareholders would become richer than any king. The idea that multinational, profit-obsessed corporations would ignore a veritable goldmine of a cure because it's too natural, or because it would upset their current business model, is a fantasy. Greed doesn't work like that. It hunts. It exploits. It commodifies. If these things worked, they would be the most expensive, most sought-after commodity on Earth, administered in hospitals worldwide. But they aren't. They're sold in the shadows of the mainstream. They use the language of conspiracy because they cannot pass the test of open, rigorous science. Their existence on the fringe isn't proof of a brave rebellion against a corrupt system. It's evidence of their failure to meet the most basic standard of that system. Standards that, for all its flaws, are designed to separate what works from what is merely wished for, and to protect us from what is actively harmful. The modern quack points to the greed of Big Pharma. The historical quack pointed to the greed of the doctor, and all of their motives were suppression. But you must ask, who is truly profiting here and now? It's not a faceless corporation. It's the influencer. It's the travelling salesman. It's the guy with the discount code. It's the guru with a paid webinar. They are the ones turning your fear directly and immediately into their gold. They have simply cut out the middleman of proof and replaced it with a currency of belief. The history of quackery is fundamentally a history of human desire. The desire to feel no pain. The desire to protect one's loved ones. The desire for a simpler answer in a complex, frightening world. The hucksters of every era have not created these desires. They have merely learned to bottle them and sell them back to us at a markup that often costs more than gold. It costs us our health, our reason, and sometimes our lives. Protect yourself. Your body is not a temple to be purified with poison or a battery to recharge with pseudoscience. It's a complex, magnificent organism that deserves care based on evidence, not on eloquence. In a world where the past snake oil is perpetually repackaged for the future, the most powerful tonic you can take is a long, sober look at the label and the courage to ask, "Where have I heard this before?" So, if this journey from the opium-laced nursery to the bleach-peddling internet forum has given you pause, and just before I sign off, please remember, to use my discount code linked in the show's description for Dr. Quackenstein's Miracle Oil, where all of life's problems will melt away. You will be cured of every illness and disease, and you will live for 1,000 years. Yeah, I'm really sorry I couldn't help myself there. In all seriousness, before we go, a quick word. If this story stuck with you, it would mean the world if you left a rating or a review wherever you're listening. A little tap of a star is the single biggest way you can help new listeners find us in the wilds of the algorithm. And if you know someone who'd be gripped by this kind of history, please share it with them. If you want to support the show more directly, you can find our links to our socials, our merch store, and our Patreon in the show notes, and also the episode description below. Members get episodes completely ad-free, which is a great way to dive even deeper. If you haven't hit subscribe yet, please do so. It's the best way to make sure you never miss a story. Your support is what keeps us digging into these dark corners. And thank you again for your support. So with all that out the way, don't forget, if you're looking for another strange story to dive into, check out our sister show, Dark's Travelling Emporium. Thank you again for listening. Join us next time for our next episode as we delve into another event and more dark history.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.